bottom of page 176. The rabbi's descriptions of Eretz Yisrael's greatness are too lengthy to mention, because you will find them talking about Eretz Yisrael almost incessantly throughout various Midrashic literature and Talmudic literature. The Khuzari says in paragraph 21, top of page 177, tell me some of the words, whatever you remember offhand. So these are sort of like the classic highlights from the words of our sages where they extol the virtues of the land of Israel. So paragraph 22, the rabbi said, here are some of the things they said on the subject. All may be coerced to move to Eretz Yisrael, but not all may be coerced to leave Eretz Yisrael. That's the language of the Mishnah. It's a Mishnah in Maseches Ksuvos. It was actually something we're learning in the Daf Yomi now is Maseches Ketuvot. And it says that Hakol Malin LaEretz Yisrael, that you can coerce anyone to move to Eretz Yisrael. Now, what does it mean you can coerce anyone? I cannot just grab you and put you on a plane. It means that a husband may coerce his wife and a wife may coerce her husband. If either one of them wants to live in Eretz Yisrael and the other one doesn't, then the spouse who wants to move to make Aliyah has the advantage. And he can say, or she can say, I'm going, whether you like it or not. Okay? Now, don't try this at home. You should speak to a rabbi before you do anything like this. In other words, don't take the law into your own hands. They similarly ruled that a woman who does not wish to immigrate to Eretz Yisrael with her husband may be divorced without receiving the compensation of her ksuva. Now, a ksuva is an alimony settlement that a husband is obligated to pay to his wife. That's the purpose of writing the ksuva. It's to create a disincentive for a husband to arbitrarily divorce his wife. But it's also designed as a financial protection for a woman who is married and then gets divorced, that she should not be left bereft of any economic support. And the only exception is that if a woman does something criminal over the course of the marriage, if she's guilty of infidelity or something like that, then she forfeits the ksuva, she forfeits the alimony, which is very similar to divorce court in certain locales today as well. Another reason why she would forfeit her ksuva is if she refuses to make aliyah. The husband says, I'm going to Eretz Yisrael, it's time for us to make aliyah, and she says, no, I don't want to go. So the halacha is the husband has grounds for divorce because they're not going to be able to live together anymore. But whereas normally if the husband initiates a divorce, he must pay the wife's ksuva, in this situation, because the marriage is breaking up because of her refusal to make aliyah, she does not get her ksuva. And conversely, if the husband does not wish to immigrate along with his wife, we force him to divorce her and pay her the amount of her ksuva. But if she's the one who says, I'm leaving, I want to make aliyah, it's time, and he refuses, he says, no, I want to stay here, then since he's the cause of the breakup of the marriage, because she has the upper hand since she's doing the virtuous thing of moving to Eretz Yisrael, we force him to divorce her, and she gets the ksuva because she's not the fault, or she's not the cause of the breakup of the marriage. Now, this is a very interesting halacha. It's quite explicit in the Gemara in Ksuvas. And as a matter of fact, there's a very, very prominent case that happened about 30 years ago was with a very prominent Rosh Yeshiva who was living in Eretz Yisrael at the time, and he was told that because of a death in the family, he needed to come back to the States to take over the yeshiva. And his wife, who was part of another very, very distinguished rabbinical dynastical family, she said, I'm not leaving Eretz Yisrael. I respect your desire to become the Rosh Yeshiva, but I don't have to leave. I mean, there's a halacha that you can't force me to leave. And so she was within her rights, and as a result, she refused to accept the get. And she was within her rights to not accept the get, because she has a right to stay in Eretz Yisrael. The solution for this kind of dilemma was something called Heter Meir Rabbanim, where the rabbi could not coerce his wife to receive her get. there's a Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom that says that even though by biblical standards a wife can be sort of be divorced against her will, like a husband according to rabbinical to biblical standards can throw a get into his wife's mailbox and she's divorced as soon as it lands in her property. But according to Rabbeinu Gershom's Cherem, that's not civil, and that's not a proper thing to do. And a woman has to be therefore convinced to accept her get. She refused. She says, I'm in within my rights. And the rabbis agreed with her. But the question is, now this is a case of the husband's an aguna, not the wife. So, or an agun. Maybe not a goon, but an agun, right? And so what was the solution? So there was another Beis Din that gave what's called a heter meir rabbanim, which is that they said as long as you get, this was also part of the loophole of the cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, that he said that even though a man may not have more than one wife, but if 100 rabbis endorse in this unique case for this man to be married, to take a second wife, that can override the cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom. And this was the mechanism that was utilized by this Rosh Yeshiva to allow him to leave Eretz Yisrael. He left the get, but she never accepted it. And the rabbis gave him a heter to take a second wife.
And to leave Eretz Yisrael.
And she never got
married? What did the government think of
it? I don't know. I don't know that the government took a stance on it.
She never got divorced.
As far as I know, she just never accepted the get. I mean, she had her family, she had her children, and she said, I don't need to get remarried. Yes.
But why does it say that? I mean, wouldn't you think that a marriage would be the highest priority as opposed to living in Eretz Yisrael?
You might think that, but that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that there is an even higher value to the individual Jew, even than marriage. And look, I have to tell you this, on a practical basis, if one of the spouses says, I'm leaving whether you come or not, then obviously the marriage is not on solid ground to begin with. And so what the Talmud is essentially saying is that if a person comes to a realization in his or her life that I can't accomplish my spiritual destiny unless I'm in Eretz Yisrael, then that takes a higher priority even than the sanctity of a marriage.
We always learn that when someone gets divorced, the Mizbeach cries. I never heard that if someone leaves Eretz Yisrael, the Mizbeach cries. I mean, there are legitimate reasons for leaving Eretz Yisrael.
Right, there are. And the Gemara identifies those. One of them is even to get married. But you can only leave temporarily. You can't leave for an extended period. You know, whenever we see these midrashim about things that are to be taken as metaphor, because the Mizbeach doesn't literally cry, the Chazal are trying to convey to us the tragedy of a divorce. But they're not telling us, they're not speaking in halachic terminology to tell us what is a higher priority than another. And so you see from this Gemara that clearly there's a priority placed on the actualization of one's own spiritual needs, even over the needs of the marriage. Which I think is pretty progressive when you think about it. We're basically saying that if a woman feels in her life that she needs to realize her own personal spiritual destiny, then she's allowed to even say to her husband, I'm sorry, this is my spiritual connection to the land of Israel and to the Ribono Shalom is more important than, you know, taking care of the domestic needs of your home. And I'm leaving, and I can opt out. I have the legal right to opt out of a marriage. It is pretty progressive when you think about it. But there are many people who have debated this issue according to halakha in the modern times. That's why I gave you this handout today, which is a very small handout. Which the first part is the Gemara that we just saw quoted by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Tanu Rabbanan, the Talmud teaches, Hu omer la'alot, v'hi omer shelo la'alot. If he says, I want to make aliyah, and she says, I don't want to make aliyah, kofin ota la'alot, we coerce her to make aliyah. What do you mean we coerce her? We don't put handcuffs on her and stick her on a plane. We tell her, you're obligated according to halakha to go. And if she still refuses, there are consequences. You know, and there could be very legitimate reasons for her saying, I'm not making aliyah. I've got a 97-year-old mother, I'm not leaving her alone. So you want to make aliyah, so go ahead. And he can say, I'm sorry, but this is my time. If not now, I don't know when I'll be able to go. And this is what sometimes creates conflict. So the imlav teitzei b'lo ketuva, and if she still refuses, after we place the halachic requirement on her to make aliyah, then they have to divorce and she forfeits her ketuva. He omer et la'alot, if she says, I want to make aliyah, v'hu omer shelo la'alot, and he says, no, I'm not going. Kofino to la'alot, v'imlav yotzi v'yitein ketuva. We coerce the husband to make aliyah, and if he still refuses, then he has to divorce his wife and he has to pay her ksuva because she's in the right.
What if he doesn't want to divorce his wife?
Well, I guess he's got some decisions to make. You cannot remain married and be in two separate countries. That's criminal. It's criminal for a husband to say that I'm going to live in a different country and I'll stay married. Halachically, a husband and wife have to live in the same house in order to be properly married. Once they live in two separate homes, then either spouse can say, I want a divorce. And whoever refuses is the again, is acting treacherously, and pressure must be brought to bear on that person to do the right thing. And that's where, you know, we have all of these aguna issues come up, where it's already been established by the rabbis that it's usually the husband, much more often than the wife, that the husband is in the wrong, and he's been living apart from his wife for months or years, and so you got to give her a get. I was on the plane from Israel. There was a new Israeli movie. I think it's called Aguna. Is that what it's called?
The Get.
Which it seems such a caricature of the Beis Din system. It just didn't seem realistic, but it depicted that whole process of a woman trying to get a get from her husband and the Beis Din not cooperating with her because they were misogynist or whatever it was. I'm hoping that this is not an accurate depiction. Okay. The next part of the Gemara that the Kuzari does not quote is, he omeris latzeis, v'hu omer shelo latzeis. Let's say they're living in Eretz Yisrael. She says, I want to leave, I want to move to the U.S. or to Canada. And he says, no, I want to stay in Israel. So kofen otah shelo latzeit, we tell her that she's in the wrong. V'imlav teitzei b'lo ketuva. But if she insists on leaving Eretz Yisrael, then we force them to divorce and she forfeits her ksuva. And conversely, hu omer latzeit v'hi omeret shelo latzeit. And that's the case of the Rashiva that I told you. He says, I want to leave. And she says, I'm not leaving Eretz Yisrael. Kofen otah shelo latzeit. We tell him that he's in the wrong and that he doesn't have a right to leave. V'imlav, but if he refuses, yotzi v'yitein ketuva, he has to divorce his wife and give her the ketuva. But because he's in the wrong in this case, where this Rosh Hashiva that I mentioned, she was in her right to refuse acceptance of the ketuva. Now Tosfos over here, it's a very controversial Tosfos commentary. Tosfos, of course, as you know, was written in the medieval period, sometime around the 12th or 13th century. And the Tosfos commentary over here says, Eino noheg bizman hazeh. This law does not apply today. Where hu omer la'alot, he says, I want to make aliyah. Why does this law not apply today? Why is it no longer true that a husband may coerce his wife to make aliyah, or a wife can coerce her husband? De'ika sakanat derachim. What does that mean?
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous to travel to Israel in the 12th century. It's dangerous. So by what right do you have to endanger your spouse by fulfilling your own spiritual destiny? And because of the dangers involved in taking a ship that you'll be on the water for months or weeks, and then having to get camels or donkeys and travel through the desert from Alexandria to all of these different exotic destinations, it is therefore no longer a halachic reality that we can coerce a spouse to make aliyah. V'haya omer Rabbeinu Chaim, and furthermore, one of the Tosafists, his name was Rabbeinu Chaim, De'achshav eino mitzvah ladur be'eretz Yisrael. That nowadays it is no longer a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. Ki yesh kama mitzvot hatluyot ba'aretz. Because after all, he says, there are many Israel-related mitzvot, agricultural mitzvot he's talking about, trumot, ma'asrot, shemitah, all of these mitzvot that are very, very heavy. The kama onshin, and there are many punishments for the non-observance of those mitzvot. De'en anu yucholim lizaher bahem v'la'amod bahem. And we don't have the ability, we don't have the wherewithal to be able to properly abide by all of these restrictive laws, agricultural laws. So therefore, that is another reason why there is no longer, this halacha no longer applies. In other words, Rabbeinu Chaim seems to be saying that even if we obviate the problem of sakanat derachim, of the danger of getting to Eretz Yisrael, even if we were able to go in an airplane and it's perfectly safe, there's still another reason why you cannot coerce a spouse to make aliyah, because the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael no longer applies because of the great liability of living in Eretz Yisrael, that you may end up violating mitzvot that you would not have violated had you stayed in Chutz La'aretz. You see, so this is a very interesting Tosafist commentary. Yes?
I just have a question about the rabbi, that case that you mentioned with the rabbi who wanted to leave. The rabbis, how did they do it again? They did something, you said that they did something, they allowed him to actually be divorced, even though she didn't accept the get.
No, they didn't allow him to be, she wasn't divorced, she never accepted the get.
So was he able to get married again?
They gave him a heter to take a second wife.
So how come they can do that with a man, and they won't do that with women who are out of the house?
That's a good question. I was waiting for someone to ask that question. Thank you, Linda.
Did he have to stay around
long still? The question is, according to the law, he has to give her the ketubah. He has to give her the alimony payment. I don't know what was arranged with that. There was probably a requirement for child support anyway, because he had children that he had to support. So I don't know.
Well,
so the question is, why don't we do the same thing for women? If a woman is an aguna, why don't we have 100 rabbis sign a piece of paper and say that she's allowed to take a second husband? Well, the answer is because according to biblical law, and even according to Talmudic law, a man is allowed to practice polygamy. But a woman is not allowed to practice, I think it's called polyandry. She's not, a woman, according to biblical law, may only have one husband at a time. A man may have multiple wives. And this is even the practice in Arabian countries, even today, where there are still very few Jews. But we all know stories of people who came from Morocco and Tangiers and Iraq and Yemen who had more than one wife. And the law of return in Eretz Yisrael allows for, if you married two wives in Chutz La'aretz, you're allowed to remit. That's what Baba Sali Abu Chatzera, that he came with two wives to Eretz Yisrael, and he was permitted to remain married to them. So that's the answer. That's the basic answer to your question. The rabbis can circumvent rabbinic law by creating this mechanism, but they cannot circumvent biblical law. The biblical law says that a woman cannot have more than one husband.
But didn't that same rabbi, he was the one who banned that, right? That same, it's not that rabbi Gershom.
Rabbeinu Gershom, who was an early...
That, right?
He's what?
Didn't he ban multiple wives?
He banned polygamy. But he said, it concomitantly with the ban on polygamy, there's an escape clause. And that escape clause is that if 100 rabbis do permit someone to take a second wife, then the ban no longer applies. That's the difference. Yes?
Why does the Torah say that a woman can't have another husband?
So the simple answer is ask God. I didn't write the Torah, God did. But that's too flippant, and it's not respectful to your question. It's a valid question. We can conjecture as to why. We don't really know the reason because the Torah doesn't tell us the reason. But conjecturally, we also understand that the roles of men and women from a biblical standpoint, from a Torah standpoint, are different roles. The woman is supposed to be the Akeret HaBayit. She's supposed to be the creator and the maintainer of the spirituality of the home. And she is sort of the foundation of any social contract that a man and a wife make with each other. And as such, she can't maintain more than one household. Sure, her role is to be monogamous to one home, to one husband, and to her children. A husband's role is more of a social creature than a woman's role. He's not as homebound, so to speak. He's not as connected to one household as much as the woman is. And therefore, he can travel from one household to the other. That seems to be the conceptual difference between a man and a woman as far as why a man can be polygamous and a woman cannot be, according to biblical law.
What about STDs?
Okay.
I don't understand that.
Okay, that's, I think, a more advanced question, which I think I'm going to put on the side. Okay.
Another consideration is you wouldn't know who the father
was.
Who would the father of the child be if she has two husbands?
That's also, I think that's a legitimate consideration also. To be able to identify the parentage, you'd have to, right? That's true. If one woman were to be married to more than one man, you'd never be able to verify who the parent is. But right, I think that's a very practical reason as well. The reason why I brought in this Tosafist commentary, so I hope I answered your questions, but the reason why I bring in this Tosafist commentary is because Reb Yehuda Halevi is emphatic that this law of the Talmud does apply nowadays. He does not agree with Rabbi Chaim. He does not agree with the Balei HaTosafot who say that the law of coercing a spouse to make aliyah does not apply anymore, because either it's dangerous to travel or because the mitzvot hatliot ba'aretz, the Israel connected laws, agricultural laws like Shemitah and Trumos and Maestros are too difficult to perform and there's a potential liability. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi does not reckon with any of that. And it's important for you to know, and we have this discussion, one of the appendices of this book, I believe it's Appendix B in the back of the book, if you want to see a little bit more of a discussion on this matter, that this debate among the Rishonim, amongst the medievalists, as to whether or not there's a mitzvah bisman hazeh of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and there is such a debate, it's clear that we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and like the Ramban, who says quite clearly that the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael does apply even bizman hazeh, even nowadays. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote a tshuva, and there have been many, many writings about this, but he wrote a tshuva and he said that the mitzvat asei deoraita of living in Eretz Yisrael is one of the 613 commandments. As it says in Sefer Bamidbar, "V'horashtem osav yishavtem ba, v'rishtem osav yishavtem ba," that you shall inherit the land and you shall dwell in the land. That is one of the 613 commandments. The only thing is that Rav Moshe says is that it's a mitzvah kiyumit and not a mitzvah chiyuvit. What is the difference between those two terms? He says it's a mitzvah for which the performance of that mitzvah grants you a reward, but the non-performance of the mitzvah does not bring punishment. So for example, there's a mitzvah of tzedakah, right? Every dollar that you give to tzedakah, you get another mitzvah. If I don't give tzedakah, do I get a penalty? No, not really. There's no specific penalty that you get for not giving tzedakah. Once you've given your minimal requirement of, let's say, one pruta for the year, like one small coin for the year to charity, any additional amount of tzedakah you give, every additional dollar, is a mitzvah kiyumit. You get points for doing it, but you don't get punished for not doing it. You understand? He says that's the way the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be viewed, bizman hazeh. I just got in my email yesterday that Rav Chaim Kanievsky was quoted as saying that today every single Jew has an obligation to live in Eretz Yisrael. Mm-hmm. Now, it's very, very dangerous when you get an email like that because you never know the context and you never know whether he was quoted correctly. And so you have to take it with a grain of salt. Yes?
There was a video of somebody...
Oh, you're familiar with this email?
Somebody obviously had your concerns. There is a video, and it's taken of him from two angles. You actually hear him say it twice.
Yes.
Of him, somebody asking that question, and Rev Kanievsky answering that there is a mitzvah. It's on Yeshiva World News. I can...
Okay, yeah, please forward it to me. But when he says, yes, it's a mitzvah, what does he mean? Does he mean it's a chiyuv? Does he mean it's an obligation? Or does
the question was, I'll forward it to you, but the question was, so-and-so, this young man made Aliyah seven months ago, and the question is it an obligation, is it required, you know, is it a chiyuv? I don't remember the exact question, actually.
See, the wording is very important.
Is it a mitzvah?
That's why, yeah.
He said, yes, it's a mitzvah today.
All right, so that's why the wording is very important, because sometimes just small nuances can change the whole reality of the psak. Yes?
Can you repeat what you mean by it's a mitzvah or it's not a mitzvah? It's obligation or it's not obligation?
Yes, there's two different kinds of mitzvah. One mitzvah is, it's a good thing for me to do, but if I don't do it, I don't get punished. The example is, every time I do a chesed, every time I do tzedakah, I get reward. But by not doing chesed, right, I don't get punished for that, right? So Rav Moshe Feinstein says that's what Bizman Hazeh, that's what nowadays living in Eretz Yisrael is like. If you do it, you get reward, but if you don't do it, you're not going to get a punishment. You understand? But there are other mitzvot, let's say like Shabbat observance, right? If you do it, you get reward, and if you don't do it, you get punished, right? Or kashrut or whatever. Yes?
But I'm still having trouble understanding why it's a greater spiritual value to live in Eretz Yisrael as opposed to saving your marriage. I'm talking about people who are already married. Because there are so many mitzvot that you're able to do when you're married that you can't do when you're not married. You know...
And there's so many mitzvot that you can do when living in Eretz Yisrael can't do when living
but
in Chutz Laaretz.
When I think about it, I think there are many more mitzvot that you can be mekayim when you're married and having children and raising children.
No, this has nothing to do with children. First of all, if we're dealing with a young lady, she'll say, okay, I'll just find another husband when I move to Israel. Or if she's already a bubby, she'll say, I had my children already. I even have my grandchildren. So what do I need this anymore?
But there are so many opportunities for mitzvos and chesed when you're married to do even to your spouse that you wouldn't have when you're single. If you assume the person will just get remarried, okay, fine, I can understand that. But it's not so easy to get remarried.
It's not so easy, but listen, but you see from Chazal clearly, I mean, this is not even Rabbi Yehuda Levi innovating this.
I understand.
He's citing from Chazal that a person has a right to make a value judgment and say that I can become closer to the Ribono Shel Olam living in Eretz Yisrael even as an unmarried woman than I can living in Chutz Laaretz as a married woman.
So that's what I don't understand, because I would think that marriage would be such an important vehicle for getting closer to Hashem.
I think for many people it is, but I think for many people it's a very subjective thing. For many people, they can feel they can get closer to Hashem as a single woman living in Eretz Yisrael. And there's stories about this throughout Jewish history, about, you know, women who made aliyah after they became widows, and they did amazing chesed, going from one end of the land to the other. Remember, we learned that story about Rebbetzin Falk from the 17th century, the mother of the Jerisha and the Parisha, that she made aliyah at the end of her life, and she was amazing. She was like, she never stopped learning. And
I'm not saying there aren't opportunities for chesed if you move to Eretz Yisrael. What I'm grappling with is this dismantling a marriage.
I understand. I understand. I understand. I register your disturbance.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, we'll take let's take one more.
Okay, you were saying that if you don't move to Israel, there isn't a punishment.
That's what Rav Moshe Feinstein says. Okay. I'm not prepared to say that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi holds the same way. Because he seems to say in a few places, which we'll get to, that a person has one of the 613 commandments that you're obligated to do.
I see here on page 179 that it says that, I know I just sort of my head a little bit. But it says that in the case of someone who had the opportunity to live in Eretz Israel during his lifetime but opted not to, it is forbidden to transport such a person to Eretz Israel after his death, because during your lifetimes you placed my inheritance as an abomination.
Yeah, that's pretty strong, huh? Well, we will get to that next time, if God will. Okay. Okay.
Can I just ask one more quick thing? But not everybody agrees that it's a mitzvah. Is that not true? One of the 613.
Reb Chaim Cohen says it doesn't apply bisman hazeh. And there's a debate whether what the Rambam holds. The consensus is that even though the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvot does not list Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is one of the Taryag mitzvahs, is one of the 613 mitzvahs. It's not because he holds that there's no mitzvah. He holds because living in Eretz Yisrael is a prerequisite for so many other mitzvahs that it's implicit in the Taryag mitzvahs. Do you understand? In other words, there's a mitzvah to tithe. There's a mitzvah to observe Shemitah. All of those are contingent upon one's living in Eretz Yisrael. So the consensus of those who interpret the Rambam say that even though he doesn't count it as one of the 613, he still holds that there's a biblical obligation to live in Eretz Yisrael. Just that it's not one of the 613 because it's not a specific mitzvah. It's a foundational rule that requires you, that is required in order to fulfill so many other commandments. But it's a much longer discussion about the mitzvah nowadays of living in Eretz Yisrael. But I wanted to give you sort of a taste of that.